Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 124 of Registry Matters. Larry, I have one thing that I want to tell you before we get anything going. You ready?
I'm ready.
I have complete and total control over this podcast, and that's just the end of the story.
Well, I'm glad someone does, because I know I don't.
Well, that's good, because, I mean, I can't even delegate this one out. I'm not even going to ask any extra parties, any of the 57 states, if they're in charge. I am in complete control.
Well, I think I've heard that similar language over the preceding week.
That's my point. Did you break any tires this week?
I did not. I did pick up another grocery order at the ClickList through the ClickList process, and it went smooth, and I'm sold on this. I don't know if I'll ever do major shopping again in the stores.
But you didn't gash any tires. That's the question. It wasn't another $300 a weekly grocery bill?
No, it didn't do that. I can't believe that I can't spot a piece of metal sticking up in an asphalt parking lot. That's ridiculous.
Maybe you need new glasses.
I just got them 5 years ago.
That may be time for you to adjust them ever so slightly.
I'm not having any problem.
Is this going to be another COVID-19 show?
Well, it seems like that's the dominating force to be reckoned with. All of the news is leading off and then significant segments of the news. And then with the courts being on reduced operations, there's not a lot coming out of courts. Anything that's in the courts has to do with the pandemic. It's related to prison release, with election postponements. It has to do with everything related to the pandemic. And then the flood of lawsuits is going to be coming afterwards for people who are harmed that could have been possibly saved. I mean, this is just the beginning of what we're going to be dealing with over this pandemic.
That is a question I've wanted to ask you. Of course, I realize that you're not a lawyer, not a constitutional lawyer, blah, 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 blah. People have a constitutional right to a speedy trial. How does that play into the fact that the courts are shut down?
Well, we're going to have to have this be litigated to find out, because the courts are taking a handoffish approach. For example, I believe it was the Legacy Church here in Albuquerque. It's one of the large mega churches filed a lawsuit saying that they shouldn't have been closed down. And forgive me if I've got the wrong church, but it was one of the mega churches. And the federal judge just rejected that this past Thursday or Friday, that the public health takes paramount importance. So the question we're going to have answered is that your constitutional right to a speedy trial, does that go away when we have circumstances beyond everyone's control? Clearly, I think we would all admit that if we're in social distancing and the courts can't operate, that you really can't blame the prosecution for not bringing the person to trial. And that's what that's designed to protect, is a person languishing at the hands of a prosecution that's not ready to go forward. But if the prosecution can't go forward, I don't know how we can hold them accountable. But then what's the balancing, the remedy? What's the remedy for people whose speedy trial right is being violated? Of course, the easy one is to release them from custody if they're in custody.
Right. I mean, and that's certainly where that goes. You could have maybe detained them, booked them, gotten their fingerprints, DNA swap, whatever all those things are, and then said, we'll call you when things progress after we're done dealing with this outbreak.
Well, I mean, I don't see a lot of creativity in how this is being handled. You know, we've talked about on previous podcasts about using the GPS monitor, which you're so fond of, for using it for graduated type sanctions and for a more individually tailored situation. Well, we could do the same thing on these speedy trials. Since people are presumed innocent under the Constitution, we could come to them and tell them we have an option for you that we would like to propose that you waive your right to speedy trial in exchange for being released on home confinement if they're in custody. And I just about bet you people that are facing the ravaging spread of COVID-19 in a correctional facility get the opportunity to waive their speedy trial to be on community custody. I just about bet you almost everyone will accept that.
Probably. Just that one more day of freedom.
we would get to use some of your famous technology that you're so fond of.
Woohoo! I am about some technology. But going back to the question I asked you about COVID, I mean, everything that I listen to, which goes across politics, goes across religion, goes across tech, there is no news other than things that are related, tangentially related, being impacted by COVID.
Well, and that's the situation we're in here. I mean, we could talk about recent decisions, but there's not anything really being decided that that's coming across my radar of significance. If we talk about the problems with the registry, I mean, other than existing problems we've been talking about for 123 episodes, the problems now we're dealing with are related to COVID-19 and how are they handling that.
Yeah.
I mean, anything that we talk about has a connection to it with people that are afraid that if they don't report to their designated officer at the designated time, they're going to be prosecuted. All that stuff is related to the pandemic. So if we don't talk about the pandemic, it really limits what we can talk about.
Well, there you go. Well, so this one will not be at all COVID related. And I think that this might be roughly the only, I don't want to say it's the only one tonight, but coming from law.com and the Texas lawyer, a gay judge in Texas was sanctioned for displaying the rainbow flag. Was she wrong? This is a narrowly elected judge in Texas, and we don't know how big it is, but she displays the rainbow flag in her courtroom, and someone has decided to be, I'm just going to call it for how I see it, Larry, being a bigot and suing to have that removed, sanctioned, whatever the right words are. Do I have that semi-right characterized?
I do think that's about as good a description. The judicial, what they call, similar to our Judicial Standards Commission, the Judicial Review Commission there in Texas was made aware of this as a complaint of some sort. And under their canons of judicial conduct, they felt like that the display of the flag would tend to cause litigants to wonder if they had an impartial court. And I didn't feel like in pre-show discussion that we really have enough information to know what the display consisted of. Are we talking about what's the size of the flag? Where was it displayed? Was it on the desk? Was it on the wall? Was it a large flag? Was it a small flag? Was it a replica? You know, I just don't feel like we know enough about it. But what I can say is that when you're on the job, you don't have unlimited rights to free speech and expression. You are on the clock when you're in the courtroom. When you're a judge, you're still on someone's clock.
Definitely. I've heard people debate this from the point of view of, like, in a school, if you were, you know, I've heard stories of maybe a Muslim kid being bullied, and then they go into the guidance counselor to try and get some sort of relief, some sort of safe zone, and you walk in there and there's a super duper big cross on the wall, you may not feel so like you're in safe harbor if the person you're going to try and get relief from is potentially in the same camp as the people that are bullying you for having a different faith than they are. I'm not trying to pick sides. I'm not trying to say who's right or wrong, but you may feel odd in that regard.
I would certainly say that you would feel odd. I think that as being in, when anytime you're in the majority, it takes a special effort to be considerate of how people will perceive and feel things that are not in the majority. And that runs across the board for religious, being in the religious majority, being in the ethnic majority. When they're in any type of ceremony, and some are, I'm not sure after COVID-19, they'll be so fond of holding hands and coming together in a circle, but they have no hesitation to ask you, would you please bow your head and let's hold hands together. But then at the end of that, at the conclusion of that, if there's a person who was not a Christian, if they were to say, okay, now let's do my religious thing, those very same people would say, no, I don't believe that way. And they would be very intolerant. And it's hard for them to even relate to, because in their world of experience and their life of experience, everybody's a Christian.
Yes. And I, you know, it's funny that the comment you were making, I think it was last week at the end of the show when you did your really, really poor imitation, the point that was you were making was an excellent point, but we were trying to pick on you about the accent.
Well, I probably could do it better if I practiced more, but I was trying to make that point. When someone is different from you, you already have your skepticism level higher. If you go into a hotel that's American owned and the people look very similar to you and they talk very similar to you, your reaction is going to be a lot different than when you go when they have the foreign accent. They have a little bit different. And Americans look that we don't have. There's nothing that describes what an American look like because it looks like because we're a diverse country. But in your sphere of who surrounds you, you have your idea of what Americans look like. At least many people do. When you go into a Middle Eastern owned hotel. And the person, for example, if they were dressed a little differently and they speak a little differently and they were to say, no, madam, I can't rent to you because it violates my religious beliefs, you would not be very tolerant of that because you'd say, well, wait a minute, your religion doesn't belong in this business. You would be indignant. I don't think many people could honestly say that if a person said, I won't carry you in my taxi cab because you're not accompanied by a man and my religion, you just wouldn't tolerate that. So that's the point we're making is that we tend to be more tolerant of what we understand.
Of course.
No, and totally. And the person who goes to the guidance counselor and sees many symbols of Christianity, they probably would be a little bit hesitant to talk to the Christian because they wouldn't think that the Christian could identify with what they're feeling.
Well, and then back to this, personally for me, if I walked into a courtroom and saw that flag, I would be like, this person is a compassionate person that understands multiple people being oppressed and picked on. Perhaps I will get leniency here. To me, that's what it would imply to me in seeing that flag. Now, that might not be at all how this judge actually acts, but that's what it would indicate to me.
But remember, and that's the way I would perceive it, but remember when you walk into a courtroom, if you watch people's court, remember there's two parties, there's two sides to a case. Remember when the police walk in, if it's a criminal case or if it's a civil case, remember when the other side walks in, they're supposed to have that same feeling of impartiality. It's mm-hmm. not just you as a defendant in a criminal yeah. action that's supposed to feel like the judges. Every party to that action is supposed to feel like the court is totally neutral. And that's what a court is supposed to be. Now, humans can't be totally neutral because we're humans.
Yeah, but like when the other party walks in. How your hair is. I mean, you talk about this sort of thing all the time of don't walk in there with bolts and screws in your face. And, you know, certainly people in the military, like they often have a tattoo on the upper part of their arm. But if you have tattoos on your face, like all of these things color how people perceive you.
That is correct. And so the other litigant may not feel the same way. A litigant that's coming from a more conservative viewpoint, in particular, if it's a law enforcement officer, they might say have some pejorative term that I don't think I need to say on the podcast, and they would think that possibly think that they're not going to get a fair shake, and I think that's what the Judicial Commission was looking at is does this color the flavor of the courtroom to where that where the impartiality of the presiding judge is in doubt.
And I don't know how much we touched on the purse that like there's another judge in the same, maybe in the office, whatever the right word is. And he is of Irish descent and has an Irish flag. How is that significantly different? Are you just showing that you have Irish pride? Irish people, I think, are known for being like huge drinkers. So is that what that implies?
Well, I'm not sure. I'd want to know that the flag is displayed the same way, the same size. And I'd also want to know that when we're talking about the flag of a nation, Ireland is a nation, right?
As far as I know, yes.
At least it's a province of government if it's not a full nation. But I'm not sure that there is a flag of a nation that we're talking about here. This is a flag, and I don't even want to try to describe it because I'm going to get hate mail if I do. So why don't you describe what the rainbow flag is?
Oh, well, the rainbow flag is, we have a picture of it in the show notes, but it's, so it has, looks like red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and purple, which I think is just the Roy G. Biv almost. And, that is often how, people that are part of the LGBTQ and figure out all the other letters that may go along with that, they represent that. So it's gay pride. And that's just constantly referred to as the gay pride flag, something like that.
So I think you've done a fine job explaining it.
And so send all the hate mail to me. And that's crackpot@registrymatters.co.
So it's been around for a long time. I remember when I was quite a bit younger, and I don't know if it has evolved with the evolving standards of decency, but I'm going to go to Wikipedia and see what it says. What does it mean? And that way, love who you want, when you want, without feeling like an outcast. Love is beautiful no matter what form it takes. That's what I'm seeing here on the meaning of the flag.
Sure. To move on to the next article, though, I am unable to pull it up at the moment. Can you, so the title of it, and it's from the Crime Report, it says, "Don't let criminal records bar health crisis relief," civil rights group says. Do you have that one pulled up that you can cover?
I do.
Excellent.
I do. So this is from the Crime Report. A dozen civil rights and advocacy organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union and the Leadership Conference of Civil Rights and Civil and Human Rights, have asked Congress to take immediate action to remove barriers based on arrest or conviction history for small business owners seeking COVID-19 relief under the CARES Act. So like the payroll protection program, the $376 billion that's supposed to protect payrolls. Apparently, since this is administered by the Small Business Administration, and I'm qualifying it with apparently because I have not verified this myself, but apparently either there have been denials or fear of denials for businesses because they do ask ownership. I have completed the application for our business, and they do ask ownership information. And the fear is that these businesses are being excluded because of the existing prohibition on SBA assistance for people with certain criminal records. And if you're protecting payrolls, I'm just really confused. If you've got a business that employs whatever number of people it employs, and you're trying to keep those people alive and keep them on a payroll so that they're not out holding a tin cup, why would the owners be as relevant? I mean, why would the ownership be significant? This is about getting hands into to our former employees' pockets. And if they don't have this money, most businesses, I'm told, can operate anywhere from about 16 days to about a month and a half with their cash reserves, and then they're out of business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how does the owner of the business impact that they have 100 employees? What's the difference?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. If the way when I did the application, they ask you for your payroll documentation for the calendar year 2019. And then it was based on 2.5 times your payroll, your monthly payroll cost, and that includes your payroll and your fringe benefits, your taxes related to payroll, health insurance, and those things. They ask you for that information, and then you can borrow 2.5 times that, and then it's theoretically forgivable if you meet the requirements for either recalling laid off workers or not laying anyone off during this pandemic. And I'm just wondering how it serves society's interest to have these people. Because you're actually punishing the employees if their owners are not allowed to have this help. It's not going into the owner's pocket. This is going into payroll. Now the owner might be on the payroll, but if they were that vindictive and venomous, they should have said if it's a business owned by one person, that person has one of these exclusions. But this is applying apparently to everyone who's on that payroll.
Tell me what you think about what the origin of that is. And I think I've asked you this before, but is that, I mean, there must be some page or, you know, some staffer that has some level of templates that they just copy and paste stuff into. And then they write details around the edges about stuff. And this just shows up as part of a default template to go, well, these people don't qualify because these are the worst people. And you should have thought about that before you went and committed your crime and started a business and hired two dozen people.
Well, I'm not sure this is in the CARES Act. I'm thinking it's from what I'm hearing is that it's because of the SBA's existing limitations.
I see.
Yeah, it's not actually they didn't actually drop this template into the CARES Act. Now, again, I haven't read the 900 pages of the thing.
What?
But from what I've heard on the talk shows is that this is something that's just because that's SBA existing policy. We've probably in our listening audience got some people out there who own small businesses, and I think we should extend this invitation to them that if you're in this situation, please email us and give them the real email address, because I'd like to hear if they've been denied, and if so, what they were told is their reason. But that's the rumor out there, and this whole story is about don't exclude these people because of a record. I mean, this is about helping everyone.
Yeah, so
they are Americans.
Yes. I think so. But check, you can either go to registrymatters.co and there's a contact form on the website, or registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Yeah, certainly. We would love to bring you on the program, and you can talk about how this is impacting you in a certainly in a negative fashion. that you can't do payroll. Tell me this, though, Larry, that if someone were to, let's try and say they're going to, you know, fudge the system a little bit, and they have a spouse, they have a brother, and they're not going to have anything to do with the business, but they create the business in that person's name just so that they are not, like, you know, registrant owned. How far over the line of being fraud does that cover? Does that go?
I'm not sure that would be fraud at all. People give ownership interest of businesses all the time to spouses. But according to this article, 1 in 3 Americans have some sort of criminal record.
Mm-hmm.
And those with records have an unemployment rate 5 times higher than average.
Yeah.
And the SBA has not said for sure to this report. It says in the announcement of the funding, the Small Business Administration did not specify whether existing rules blocking help to those who did not demonstrate good character, including those with criminal records, would be waived, so that they're hanging their hat on the existing rules since they're the administrator of the program.
And is that a public-private partnership, or is that just straight up an entity of the government, the SBA?
I believe it's an entity of the government created a long time ago, back in the 50s or 60s. It's been around a long time.
Like executive branch, that the head of that gets appointed by presidents when that term comes about, or?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, but I know the SBA has been around all of my life, and I've been around for a while.
Well, no doubt. And so now you can take notes that this is something that Larry didn't know right off the top of his head.
So
that's impressive that I finally, after 124 episodes, got you to go, don't really know.
formed in 1953, so I knew it's been around for a while.
You did.
1953. And it's a United States government agency that provides support to entrepreneurs and small businesses, according to Wikipedia.
Right. And, you know, I still say that that's a trustworthy source. It will end up with some garbage sometime, but it usually, like, turns around and gets fixed. I remember maybe it was somewhere during Bush Jr.'s term, people would go F with that page a lot, and they eventually had to, like, lock the page from people making updates. And so anyway. There's a whole, like, hierarchy of people trusting people before you can go edit high profile kinds of pages. If we make a Larry profile page, no one's going to mess with it because no one cares.
So that's true. But yes, this would be tragic if these folks employed in businesses owned by anyone with a record are not able to be retained because of this prohibition. And clearly a lot of people are going to be delighted to have the loan forgiven. But the alternative would be that the people would be either on the street or on public assistance or on some sort of other, you know, it's like if the business has got two to four weeks worth of reserves, these people, I mean, we've been shut down pretty much for at least a month in most states, right?
Correct. I just had a thought and it disappeared. Yep. It's gone. Sorry.
That's because you got old timers.
I know, right? All right. Coming over from Courthouse News. Private immigration prisons take away prisoners' homemade face masks. I can speak to personal experience that when you have someone that has some body funk about them, that you'll, like, wrap a t-shirt around your face. And obviously now with COVID again, that you would do kind of sort of anything. Maybe you would just lay there on your rack all day on your bunk and just, like, leave your face stuck in your pillow all day to help try and filter out whatever you can. So people are cutting up t-shirts. They're trying to do whatever they can. And then, of course, the prison guards go in and say, nope, can't do that. Take that crap away.
And what's the problem with that?
Well, you know, you're kind of in tight quarters. You're kind of confined. And I don't think that I would want to get sick. You know, I knew that I was getting a 6-year sentence. And I, you know, it was going to be a maximum of and hopefully less. Turned out not. But I also didn't want to get any extra things while I was gone, you know, perhaps like staph infections or any, you know, food poisoning or lose a tooth. And then also COVID-19.
Well, this is sad and I'm trying to poke a little fun at a sad situation. But if you read the article thoroughly, it looks like that they offered them mask, but they have to sign a waiver. Is this
correct?
The right article?
Yes, it is. They were making them sign a waiver that if they did catch it, that they wouldn't sue.
And
which is some garbage. That's one of those. God, I can't remember the word that I got from the guest.
Thank you.
Yeah, where you have two impossible choices. So don't sign the waiver. Don't get a mask. Sign the waiver and get a mask. Like, that's garbage.
Well, this is a prison in in the Houston area. So this is for illegal, for immigrants. This is one of the network of prisons we have to hold people who can't be released or being held for ICE. The Otay Mesa Detention Center is the name of it. And private prison company CoreCivic, formerly known as Corrections Corp of America, operates the Otay Mesa. And it's sad that they won't let them use homemade protection. And then if you look at the picture, if that's indicative of how crowded the place is, there would be no social distancing there.
Now, that looks more like an intake holding kind of photo. Because, I mean, they've got like aluminum something. Maybe those are even like blankets, perhaps. That doesn't look like that looks like a temporary place before they put them into the general population. But we did see videos, pictures, like, what was it, over the summertime of the kids in cages? And they were not in anything, you know, they weren't in like dorm rooms or in cells. They were in like in cages, almost on the floor. That could totally be what that is.
So, yeah, this would be, but even if this is an intake, you got quite a crowd of people there.
Definitely.
When we say that Americans are not very compassionate, as we go through the articles tonight, I'll be able to say, this is what I'm talking about. We're not very compassionate. But whether or not they're here legally or illegally, they're entitled not to a death sentence.
And they're entitled to be treated like humans, too, because I think they are humans. I'm pretty sure it might be sketchy, but I'm pretty sure they're humans.
So I would say the same thing about the people in ICE detention that I've said about the people in regular correctional facilities. We should be doing everything we possibly can to cut these populations, because that's the only way you'd have any hope of distancing would be to cut the population. And that's the only way you'd have the hope of being able to provide supplies and improve sanitation is that you can't be running something at full steam. And even in the case of one of the articles, we're going to get to 230% of capacity.
Yeah.
But you can't do that. But we're doing it, and we're not taking the bold actions that are necessary, and there's going to be a significant price paid in loss of life.
Oh man. So I have a vision of what it's going to look like as we start to reopen things here, maybe in the next week or 2 weeks, that you'll go to a restaurant and they will remove something of half the tables. They'll block off maybe half of the booths, something along those lines, so that you will obviously keep your distance. And then waiters and servers and waitresses, they will stand a certain amount back. You would have to envision that they would do something identical to that to prisons to keep people safe. And this is you voluntarily going to an establishment to have them put food in your face. But here's a place where you are detained and you cannot leave and you can't do anything to get separation. They would have to release at least half of the people, if not whatever that number is larger, if they are exceeding 100% of capacity.
And that is clearly not going to happen. The politics won't allow it to happen, and so we're gonna end up with unnecessary loss of life. And I can't even begin to predict the numbers, but you're seeing some exponential growth of the spread in some prison systems. I think one of the articles says it doubled or tripled overnight.
Yes,
I mean it's.
And then these are also people that probably wouldn't be counted properly, because, you know, they'll just sort of disappear into, you know, somebody's book that doesn't really get tracked. I mean, a place like, you know, we get articles from them all the time. Who am I thinking of? The Appeal is one of the places that maybe they would come up, but, you know, that doesn't make any level of mainstream media for anybody to give a poop about it.
So the next article is from New York. Why don't we combine that one with the governor of the other state that says also said she's not going to do anything dramatic either. So that way I can bash the liberals together.
Very good. The one we do have next is from the New York Times about the
doctor. I jumped ahead.
No, that's cool. So, but this one is from the New York Times. It says the Miami police. So it's the Miami police chief promised an investigation after a video showed Dr. Armin Henderson being handcuffed outside his home on Friday. This is a black doctor who tests homeless people for coronavirus. And the way the video runs it is he's like organizing what looks like just kind of an unmarked box van or whatever. And he's walking back and forth and someone called the police that there's a black man. There's a black man like doing something with a van. And so the cop comes by and he's like, hey, what are you doing? There's no audio on it. And Eventually, the cop gets out, handcuffs the guy, and detains him, and he's a doctor that's trying to help test homeless people. Eventually, his wife comes to his aid and shows him identification, and he gets released. But, like, why can't a black guy be in a neighborhood and doing something very nice without getting detained in some capacity? I'm not really laughing, but I can't stop laughing about this.
The officer said that he thought he was littering.
Yes. Because it looked like he was, until he took the stuff that was in his hand and, like, smashed it out. Now it's on the ground, so now he's, like, probably, like, you're littering. I got you.
So, well.
What's wrong with you people, Larry?
Well, I'm always skittish on, I mean, I deplore racial profiling, but I'm always skittish when we never want to allege that unless the evidence is overwhelmingly there. It's, to me, it demeans, it's like calling something rape when it isn't.
Yeah.
Rape is so horrible that we should never minimize it by calling something rape that isn't. We should never be tolerant of racial profiling, but we have to actually look if the evidence supports that. And unfortunately, there's no audio with this. But I mean, if you roll up on a scene and it looks like a person's littering, you are going to have some questions for them. I mean, that is, if you receive a phone call, so I'm trying to give the police just a tad bit of a doubt here. But I would find it very objectionable if he was racially profiling.
Here's a interesting story, and I always found this one to be super ironic. That this is a lifetime ago for me, but when I was in the Army, and I was working in the orderly room where they would, you know, track all the personal paperwork and all the stuff. And one of the reports that I had to put together was to what was the ratio of the different races and what kind of awards and medals and, you know, commendations did they receive in whatever that period was. And I've always thought of it being odd that if it's something that you're tracking, then that means you could have, you know, you could assign quotas. Well, okay, so we have 10% black people in the Army, but, you know, whatever that number is. So we have to make sure that they are proportionally given awards, but now you're just standing somebody up for getting an award that might not deserve of it. But if you don't track it, then they, you know, then things might be out of whack. But I've always just found that to be a really interesting situation, that if it's something that you should be tracking, then someone's going to influence it in the direction to make it equitable for somebody that may not deserve it. But if you don't track it, then it'll be all, could be all out of whack.
Well, in a true colorblind society, it wouldn't matter if it is out of whack. I mean, you're not guaranteed a specific outcome in life. You're guaranteed, at least in my interpretation of the Constitution, an equal opportunity for that outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we are nowhere near that. Even with all the dramatic progress we've made, we still have so many barriers that stand in the way. And despite a middle class person, upper middle class person, who believes that everything is equal, it really isn't. And all you have to do is go to a place where children are growing up in poverty and look at what their chances of those children would be, even if they work every bit as hard as your children do, that their odds are heavily stacked against them. But in a true colorblind society where no one is giving any preference or disadvantage to that, you wouldn't need to track it because they would be a meritocracy. I believe that's the word I'm looking for.
I will go along with that 100% right there. I will go along with that. Yeah, I don't know how do you square that and have people, like, I like the term used, a colorblind society, and we are so very far from it. By no stretch of the imagination could you say that we are equal in that regard.
And I always like to qualify with I agree, but how much progress we've made. If we downplay the progress, then you have people out there saying, well, you liberals just don't tend to, nothing ever satisfies you. And you're right, until we reach the optimum of development, which would be a colorblind society, but we would have to be clearly willing to recognize that dramatic progress has been made. You're a whole lot better off growing up as an African American in 2020 than you were in the 1950s in the rural South. But does that mean you have equality under the law? No, it just means you have a whole lot fewer barriers than you had in the 1950s.
Definitely that. Hey, do you want to go bash Cuomo now? Isn't Cuomo doing a halfway decent job of managing New York? It seems to me that he is.
Well, if you consider being on a soapbox managing, then I would say so. I think what people are tempted to do is that they're tempted to rate their state's performance on what the governor says I would like to be a little more objective after we get beyond the crisis to rate the governors on what they actually did before the crisis, during the crisis, and what they've announced they're going to do for future pandemics, because now we've experienced one in our lifetime that's really had a dramatic adverse impact on society. So if Cuomo being in the nation's largest city, having access to the media, is he doing a fine job getting himself on TV? Yes, he is.
Okay.
Is he positioning himself to be a possible Democratic nominee for high office, including president? Yes, he is.
Okay. He talks too funny for that, I think.
Has he been right about everything? No, he hasn't. He's overestimated. According to him, they were going to have millions and millions of people dying if they didn't have all these ventilators, and he was wrong about that. It's better to err on the side of having too much than too little. But is he doing a good job? I think I'm going to let New Yorkers judge that whether he's doing a good job. But he's certainly got received a lot of notoriety.
This seems like an impossible situation for a politician. If you underestimate and the shit hits the fan, you are doomed, and you end up with things far worse than you ever anticipated. But just like a hurricane forecast would end up in the southeast, and then at the last second it detours, so they made all these preparations and like, oh, you weathermen, you're all full of crap, and then they stop listening to it in the future, and then all of a sudden the big Katrina whatever hits that area, you're like damned if you do, damned if you don't. You almost can't win.
That is true. And with this article that we're going to cover, with combining it with Oregon, my point is, I would be more pleased with Governor Cuomo if he were taking bolder action when it comes to the people incarcerated, and his action is very timid in terms of what to do about it. He's not. You're going to get bashed as a liberal. You're going to get bashed as a liberal no matter what. So you might as well do the right thing, and the right. The conservatives are going to hit you no matter what you do. When it comes to releasing people in prison, I've got to go back to the Middle East with the Yom Kippur War in 1973. Oh. When the question was, how do we save Israel from being annihilated? And there was a discussion of whether we paint over American military transport planes so that we can have plausible deniability. And of course, it would still be known that they were coming from the U.S. And the decision was made, if we're going to take the hit for an airlift, we might as well do around-the-clock airlift. If you're going to get criticized for releasing 150 prisoners or 250 prisoners, you might as well do the right thing and release as many as you can to make the institutions as safe as you can for the duration of the pandemic. Because they're going to hit you whether you release 2% of the prisoners, or whether you release 20% of the prisoners, or whether you release 40% of the prisoners, they're going to hit you, and they're going to say you're soft on crime. That they will not be able to help themselves. That's what they're going to do.
And what power does the governor have with state prisoners?
Well, I'm assuming that they have a dramatic amount of power, including most corrections systems have furlough programs, so they could probably temporarily furlough a lot of people. They have sentence reductions as a general rule, most prison systems operate at or near or sometimes above capacity. They have population reduction measures where they can shave off the time on the end of people's sentences. It's already under existing law and policy. So he could have a variety of tools in his arsenal, including moving up people's release dates under any existing law that he has in New York. He has executive powers. I mean, he could do a whole number of things. And any power he's lacking, I could just about guarantee you that since he's got a relatively progressive legislature there, he could probably get it through the legislature to the extent they're in session, which they probably are not. So he would probably have to take an executive action, because come to think about it, they're probably closed down like most of the legislatures are.
I mean, I was making a tongue-in-cheek comment about the total power at the beginning of the show, but as far as I know, the governor can just say, we're letting you go. He has the power of the pen to commute, or like you said, would a temporary furlough, would that require the legislature?
A furlough is what I'm more, I'm telling people, you don't have to release people never to come back. You can do furloughs. Most every state I've been in has a furlough opportunity. And they tend to be very selfish with granting those. And what you described is if you have a death in the family, you have to pay for an armed guard to take you to the funeral. But furloughs are my first choice is to tell people, now we can let you stay here if you don't want to agree to be furloughed, but you will be having to come back to prison when the pandemic subsides. And if you don't want to be inconvenienced by having to come back to prison, don't leave. And I suspect most people will take the furlough. But the early release would be my second choice.
Yeah. And Josh had said something about that. If someone is within that like window, like, you know, maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's 12 months, like they're probably done baking, you know, so to speak. And that 6 to 12 months probably is not going to change their quote unquote rehabilitation, which we know we don't do in the United States, but I'm just using that term just cause. So like in that case, what the hell's the difference?
Well, the difference of, I mean, I'll be a little cynical here. The difference is oftentimes, I can't say oftentimes, but if they really are out to get you, they'll wait till you get near the end of your sentence, and then they'll find something else to charge you with, assuming the statute of limitations hasn't run, and they'll file something to keep you in prison. So if we start, like if you start a matrix of releasing people that were in, and you wouldn't take long to run the computer. I mean, if you're trying to if you've got 70,000 people in prison and you're trying to get 20,000 out, you would have to run a matrix to see to figure out how many days you'd have to shave off to reduce the population by 20,000 if you were trying to merely expedite people's release. But that wouldn't be the only tool you would have. You would have furloughs you could do, and then you could look for alternative confinement. It may come as a surprise to you, but everybody doesn't have to be in prison to be confined. I mean, we've got all this fabulous technology that you talk about that we could tell people that we're putting you on home confinement. And it's like I saw a program about 30 years ago about club fed when the federal prisons were supposed to be club fed, and the ones that didn't have walls, didn't have guard towers. And we can tell a person, we're putting you on home confinement and you cannot leave home except for these situations or whatever they are. And if you leave home, we've got a place for you as an alternative where that if this is too much of a temptation, we can provide you with that additional protection so that you, if you can't help yourself. And that's what the warden would give each inmate was a speech. He said, we don't have guard towers here. We don't have perimeter fences. We don't have barbed wire. We don't have any of that stuff here. And if you feel like you need that, go ahead and let me know now, and we can reassign you to a facility that can accommodate that. But between all the tools that they have in their disposal, they could really reduce the prison population dramatically. The will isn't there. Governor Cuomo, the will isn't there in your heart to do this. And the next article from Oregon Live, the same thing. The Corrections Department did a study, of what it would take to get where they could do some social distancing. They would have to cut the prison population by almost 6,000 inmates. And the governor said, no way.
Yeah.
She's not even going to think about it.
You know, I had a funny little play that I was going to do with this. I was going to ask you like, well, what about these people? And you would just say, no. Well, what about these people? No. Well, what about these people? No. And just no, 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 no. So she's awesome. That's Governor Kate Brown.
I don't know a lot about Kate Brown, but I know that Cuomo presents himself as a progressive. So let's see it, Governor. Kate Brown, I don't know if she claims to be a progressive. Oregon tends to be somewhat of a progressive state. There's a lot of rural nature in Oregon, and they do have a very high prison population per capita. There, if you'd be surprised if you look at their incarceration rate. They're on the high side. So I don't know if we can extrapolate because they have some liberal tendencies that Kate Brown is a progressive. We'll have to let the Oregonians explain that to us. But again, she's not using the powers, and she's made it clear she's not going to.
A member of the Democratic Party. So she's a D and has decided to not release any of the peoples from that state.
Well, she's clearly fearing a backlash. But again, you're going to take a backlash no matter what you do if you release anybody. Let's see, George H.W. Bush railed on Michael Dukakis for one furlough that happened in the state of Massachusetts of Willie Horton. One furlough. Now, Willie Horton did something while he was on the furlough that was pretty heinous. But Dukakis had no idea that he was out on furlough. He didn't personally approve the furlough. The law was probably on the books before he ever was governor, and it never occurred to him. I mean, he wasn't saying, oh, well, I'm going to give the guy a weekend pass. I mean, my point is, if you release anybody for this pandemic and anything goes wrong, you're going to take a hit. So you might as well do what you need to do, or then don't do anything. Just say, look, stay there and die, and which it seems to be what Kate Brown is saying.
That totally would seem how it is being presented. How many people, Oregon, like there's 45 people that live in the state of Oregon. How many, like, how do they have 5,800 people locked up?
Where do you get the idea of Oregon? Where are you getting your population figures?
There's nobody that lives there. How many people live in Oregon? What is the prison population? Is really prison population Oregon? I mean, to release 5,800.
Oregon has over 4 million people. So I don't know.
That's a bunch of people.
So, looks like
24,000.
Yeah, they have a high incarceration rate in Oregon. And so now all of the people who get mad at me say I never bash liberals. I'm bashing liberals, two of them today. At least one for sure claims to be a liberal, and the other one I'm not sure of. But I'm bashing Democrats today.
You just gave me the title for the podcast, Larry. Thank you. Hey, can we take a quick go ahead?
In fact, I would say they're being more timid than what the federal government has been. The federal government has not been nearly bold enough, but they've been more bold than apparently these two have been. I mean, the Attorney General Barr spoke out a long time ago and gave a directive to start releasing people a long time ago, weeks ago. Hmm. So in fairness, I think that the feds have been more responsive than what these progressives have. So we have to call it the way we see it.
Can we take a quick little detour for just a moment to thank some
Absolutely.
People?
Absolutely. Yes.
I want to absolutely 100% make sure that our listeners and especially our patrons that I bring some highlight to you people that you guys help make the show possible, even just straight up listeners, because if we didn't get the 10,000 downloads a week, then we would not continue to make this. And then of course the patrons, but specifically my favorite patron, super patron Mike, super great guy, best friend of all time. And I just wanted to make sure that we highlighted that we have a very loyal fan base and listeners, and I want to make sure that we recognize that.
We do indeed, and they have been loyal with us through the crisis, and still supporting us both with the downloads. The numbers are very strong, and as far as I know, I think we've lost only one.
Yep, and he just ultimately changed his to level, so maybe he did have some hardship and just changed his contribution level.
So thank you to each and every one of you. Thank you.
Thank you, people, or just you?
Thank you. I'm talking to each one of you individually.
Should I give you a roster of names for you to thank you and you and you? What is that from? That's from a TV show.
We would be here for a while if we did that.
Yes, of course. All right, well then let's move over to Politico. And federal prisons make inmate calling and video visits free during pandemic? I'm shocked.
I remember calling for this. I think someone must be listening to Registry Matters.
That could be true.
Yes, because I remember saying that if you're going to cut off their visits, if you want to keep order in the prisons and have inmates not being so belligerent about this, that you need to make the phone calls free and you need to make visitation by the ones that have the technology for the video visits, you need to make those free. And someone is understanding that, and they're doing it. So it's a great thing.
Outstanding. And then the key would be, and I'm sure it won't happen. So as soon as quote unquote, the national crisis is lifted, do they then say, okay, now it's $7 a minute for a phone call again?
They probably do, because apparently this was part of the $2.2 trillion relief package.
Really? Subsidize?
Included language with the Justice Department's blessing, allowing the Bureau to make such communication services free for inmates if emergency conditions materially affect operations. And so some letters of some people in Congress, particular senators, had written to the Bureau saying, what are you folks doing? And the Bureau has responded, the Bureau of Prisons, that is, has responded by making this adjustment. Now, all the people that are listening to us in BOP facilities, which, believe it or not, I bet there's somebody who's figured out how to listen to us in facility because phones are in prisons more wide than what you would imagine.
Yes.
Let us know. Let us know what's really going on if they're actually adhering to this free. It's one thing to have a policy. It's another thing to actually have it implemented where people are getting access to the phones and to the visitation. If you don't have any staff because they're all infected and everybody's on lockdown, it doesn't make any difference what the policy is.
True. Did you see the note that I wrote below the link of the article? And is that something to bring up or should we skip that?
Well, it the letters that went, there weren't any Republicans mentioned. And I wouldn't expect that this would be something that I mean, the average Republican isn't thinking about this issue. We've gone over many episodes about Republicans' fear that people in prison are just a block of Democrat voters waiting to happen. So I wouldn't expect that they would be trying to be there. But I don't know if I'd make anything of it that all the letters that were mentioned went from Democratic lawmakers.
Yes, there's like 6 or 7 senators that are listed in there, and they all have D's by their name. That was just the comment that I made. I said, is it my imagination or only D's listed, no R's?
It's not your imagination. That's what the ones that have written letters. But yeah, if you're a Republican, you can write a letter because no one's going to vilify you. I keep saying that you have carte blanche to do anything in justice reform, and you will not get vilified.
All right. Well, then for detour number 2, we have a very special guest. I have a personal hotline to one of the board members of NARSAL, and he has some super secret information that he is going to divulge for us as an exclusive for Registry Matters. I think this is our first exclusive, Larry. And so joining us is Richard Morey, and he's currently a board member serving on the Conference Planning Committee and the Conference Operations Committee. And he's been involved with NARSAL for 9 years. That's like an infinite amount of time. And, of course, is an all-around nice guy. Richard, what's up?
Hey. Good evening, Andy and Larry.
Good evening. Can you say something very New Englandish for me, just so we can get the accent stuff out of the way first?
Well, I'll say, first of all, it's romper room.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Romper room.
That's the magic words, romper room.
Thank you, and thank you, and thank you.
If we want to park your car at Harvard Yard. there's lots of parking spaces at the moment because no cars are to be found in Harvard.
Oh, God, it never ceases to make me laugh. I loved listening to the program Car Talk because it's so funny to me.
They were great. They were actually
terrible, tragic them. Loss of I don't remember the individual, like the names, but
yeah,
God, yeah. Super program. What is your super secret information that you're gonna divulge for us?
I did swear you to secrecy, right? And under the penalty of perjury and death, right? You,
so not a soul this, outside so this, of this, this podcast this, will know of it.
Yep, between you and I.
Yes,
we're having a webinar. Not only are we having a webinar, but we have all the speakers that we were going to have for our conference have agreed to be part of the webinar. So that is the biggest part of the news. We're just about ready to pick a professional business, I guess is really what they are, who knows what they're doing in terms of the technology. And it looks like, I'll put it to you in its simplest term, I have become a webinar aficionado in 5 days. I have done 5 different webinars this week. And I've never done it before, and I'm telling you, this stuff is so simple. Even I'm doing it. And trust me, those who know me know that I'm the tech lowball here.
I was going to ask you on a rank of 1 to 10, where are you on the tech savviness scale?
0-3, maybe? You're below 0, minus 3. You know? I think that would be fairly accurate. Brenda could probably qualify that for you, but... Yeah, I'm not up there very far.
Well, that's cool. I didn't know about all the speakers. So, like, all of them or almost all of them?
All the speakers have signed on board with the webinar. We're going to – and we're actually – we do have some I do have some super secret things I can't even tell you yet.
Okay,
that cool. We're planning.
Excellent.
But when the COC is going to meet this week, and when we do, we're going to kick butt, actually, is what we're going to do. We're going to make this webinar so exciting and so much fun. People will be saying, we should do this like every other year.
Right. Do you know anything about pricing or anything of that nature?
Our attempt is going to be to keep the pricing very low. We may have to do a little bit because the cost of this is actually in the thousands of dollars, not in the hundreds. So there will be probably some cost, but we have an idea. I'm not going to divulge it yet, but we might be able to subsidize the cost a little bit.
Okay.
With this other idea.
Excellent. Larry, do you have anything that you would like to inject?
Well, Richard, what can you tell us?
I know, right?
It's going to be a fantastic time. We've got wonderful speakers. The lineup we had for this year's conference was really strong to begin with. And, of course, I don't have it in front of me. Although I have a brochure, but it's not handy.
Hey, Richard, what are the actual dates? June, July, what are the dates for the conference?
It's going to be June 12th and 13th. It's going to be Friday and Saturday, as we had scheduled. Actually, you know what? I think I do have...
This makes for great radio, Richard.
I know, it doesn't. But tell a joke, Andy. By the way, I want you to know something. This is the first time I participated in your chat room or green room or whatever you call it.
Sure.
And it's really fun back there.
I agree.
I mean, I may come every week just for the chat room. I mean, you can't imagine the things they're saying about you in that chat room.
I can imagine them, but actually, Brenda sometimes just hangs in chat and doesn't listen to the live stream, just because you can pick up what we're talking about.
She's sitting on a secret. She hasn't shared that with anybody. I'm telling you, I'm going to tell people.
I try to tell them every week, but nobody listens. Maybe they'll listen to you.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, they'd be the first, but you know what the hell?
Are you done rustling through papers?
I am. I have it right in front of me. So we have Kimberly Budden from the ACLU of Michigan is going to be with us. Joanne Wipajewski, I think I pronounced that correctly. She's a columnist and an editor. I think she's from the Chicago area, but I may be wrong on that. Paul Dubling, whom I think
everybody knows Paul. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows Paul. And I think he's working up a special talk for us. Phil Tafayan, who's the executive director of Equal Justice Under Law, and Dr. Fred Berlin, a psychiatrist and sexologist. So we're going to have a full-blown array of wonderful speakers. The thing we're really most concerned about is making sure we get the technology right, because if the technology doesn't work, as you know, Andy, it don't work well.
So I know a little about that sort of thing.
So we're going to... We're really wanting to focus and make sure that this comes off really well and that people are going to be satisfied with it and happy with it.
Fantastic. Larry, anything before we let Richard go?
No, Richard, I appreciate you coming on and sharing those super secrets. I just can't wait to see how... I mean, this is a new experience for NARSL in terms of doing it online, and we're going to find out what the participation level is. I have a little bit of dubiosity, but we'll see.
I'm anticipating that we may hit 300 people for this event. I haven't put my feet to the fire on that one yet, but I really think that people will be able to gravitate towards this much easier than they could in terms of flying to Raleigh, and that we more of the troops and the people who will be out there. Would like to be part of it.
Awesome.
Well, let's hope so, Richard.
Great. Well, I thank you. It's been fun to be here.
You're very welcome. Thank you for joining.
Good night.
Thanks, Richard. Have a great night, and we will talk to you soon. Stay safe.
I will.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher.
or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
You ready to move on, Larry? Now that we got that crackpot out of the way.
Yeah, let's do it. We've got 20 minutes to go through 12 our articles.
Is it 12? All right. Well, then we're going to enter into the speed round. This next one, oh my God, this one is terrible. A Philly judge has denied every inmate's bid to get out of jail amid the coronavirus. Defense lawyers are trying to cut her out of the process. This is from the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is a stellar human being. And Philadelphia County is like, they're in Philadelphia. So it's like New York is like, you're in New York City, but you're in New York. And then, so Philadelphia County and it's in Philly. This is terrible.
Well, she's doing what she put her hand on the Bible and said she would do. She's upholding the law.
I mean, I suppose, but don't judges sort of have the capacity to have compassion and think about like things in totality? Hey, you did felony jaywalking. Maybe you don't need to be in prison to where you're going to catch a deadly disease.
Well, the funny thing is it says that in some cases that she increased the detainees' bail after they filed their motion to get. Now, that's funny.
That'll teach you. Come into my court and waste my time asking for some sort of compassionate relief to get out of prison. I will just. So $5,000 bail. Let's make it $25,000.
So, well, we had a judge here in Bernalillo County that I never saw it, but I had more than one attorney say this was true, that she would ask, and she is no longer on the bench, so I don't think there's any need to name her, but she would ask when she was setting the bond, you know, are you going to be able to make that? If the person would say yes, she would say, well, I'm increasing it. So, and of course, if it's your first arrest, you have no idea. You would think that the judge is trying to make sure that since you're presumed innocent, you're going to get out, but the rumor has it, and this will be an Ashley question if this is true, because she's been practicing 25 years right here. But the rumor has it that she would say, you know, you're going to be able to make that bond. And they'd say, I believe I will, Your Honor. And she'd say, well, then it's $10,000.
That's awful. But I'm assuming that she's an elected person. I'm assuming, we talk about this frequently, that state-level judges are generally elected. Is that fair?
Generally, there's some elected component to it. I don't know in Pennsylvania, but by her action, she's either a very, very closed-minded individual, or she's afeared of something, and she's apparently that it's so egregious that the defenders are trying to get her off of the decision make out of the, cutting her out of the loop.
How does that work? How does that work? Like tactically, you know, from your point of view, of how do you get it so that aren't judges randomly ish assigned, and so you just get the short stick, and that's who you get? How do you get a judge out of that process?
Well, not knowing enough of the intricacies of the court system in Pennsylvania, I would say there'd be a number of ways you could do it. For example, usually in the larger jurisdictions, and Philadelphia would qualify for that, a judge doesn't go back and forth between civil and criminal and domestic relations in the specialized courts. They're usually assigned to a division of the court. So if she's a common pleas judge, for example, which is the trial level court, if she's a judge in common pleas and she's in the criminal division, one thing you could do would be to get her assigned to she could be assigned to domestic relations or to juvenile or that's a scary thought, but you could have her assigned to, you know, to the civil division, to one of the other divisions, and that would get her out of the process. In our state, we can excuse a judge. So what happens here is there's a peremptory challenge that either side can make, and you end up excusing a judge so many times that the reassignment happens. If that judge is never going to have a criminal case because all the defense lawyers are disqualifying, excusing the judge, they end up being assigned to do different types of work. So I don't know what all the options would be, it mentions in the article that the Supreme Court overturned one of her excessive sentences as being extremely harsh. So this is a known thing.
This is like the judge in Georgia named Amanda Williams. There were a bunch of profile, like radio programs, This American Life profiled her. She would just rake you over the coals and almost entrap you through things. Terrible, terrible,
well,
terrible.
I'm going to correct myself. I said Supreme, and I meant Superior. It says in February, okay. Superior Court overturned a 7-year prison sentence. Coral imposed, and this is the judge's name, on a man who had violated probation, saying a reasonable observer could question whether the judge comported herself in an unbiased and impartial manner, end of quote. So, you know, like I say, this is well known around the circles of what all their options are to dealing with her. I don't know.
Gotcha. And then I guess otherwise she comes up for election in another half decade or something, and then maybe she gets voted out, but probably not, because she's probably tough on crime, and that makes everyone feel all squishy inside and gets reelected.
Well, in Philadelphia, that doesn't seem to be the mood that carries the day.
True. I wonder what Larry Krasner has to say about her. They're probably besties and go golfing weekly.
I thought he was mentioned in the previous article that we were just talking about, that he was quoted in there, if I remember right, but I don't remember what he said. My old-timers has kicked in.
No kidding.
But I'm pretty sure he was mentioned in there.
District Attorney Larry Krasner said he understood Bradford Gray's position given the effort parties have put into finding candidates worthy of possible release from jail. The previous article, like the one I think you're thinking of, the Reason article, those are just two
the Philadelphia
covering.
Yeah.
They're just a companion, just different point of view on the same article. Well, I guess we can then move over to Cleveland.com. And fifth inmate dies of coronavirus at Elkton Federal Prison in Ohio. I learned that Ohio is pronounced Ahia this week.
So I have never heard that.
Yeah, that's from Ohio natives. I guess one of our patron listeners probably would know of it as Ahia, since he's from up that way. Hey, man, that's only 5. What's the big deal, right?
Well, that's one of the facilities that ends up with a lot of the federal, it's a federal facility that ends up with a lot of people that have sexual convictions. And I don't want to jump to a conclusion that that has anything to do with anything, but the prison has, it says, currently houses 1,999 male inmates and 418 in an adjacent lockup. If they haven't gotten that population down, I think this is just the beginning of what we're going to see.
Yeah, I got to think that things are going to get worser. Isn't that a word?
It is a word, and we have the way we judge it on the NARSL side. We know where the institutions are, where we send the most of our newsletters, and that is one of the top 5 where we have subscribers in Elkton.
And then I guess we can move over to we do have one from the appeal. This is a man with innocence claim is first to die of COVID-19 in Pennsylvania prison. This guy who was serving 30 years in prison and was claiming innocence and was working with possibly the Innocence Project. Is that who I saw in that article to try and get released for?
Yes, that's what you saw.
Okay.
67 years old.
I'm just going to call that shitty, Larry.
But I'm confused because I read the article and it said he was in prison, Pennsylvania prison, but then it referred to Phoenix. Is there a Phoenix, Pennsylvania?
There's probably a Phoenix everywhere.
Well, I've never heard of that.
It was held at the state correctional in Phoenix. Maybe it's just titled Phoenix and not Phoenix, PA. Anywho, yeah, so we don't have to look for that.
Yeah, we don't know, but yeah, that caught my eye when I was reading this. And then another thing that caught my eye, and of course, the name John is fairly common, but the name Wetzel is not.
That would be
true. And the corrections head is named John Wetzel. And back in the 70s, there was a basketball player for the Atlanta Hawks named John Wetzel. Did John Wetzel go into the corrections business after he retired from basketball back in the days when they paid him $30,000 a year?
Well, I mean, that's possible. You always hear about sports people opening up restaurants. I don't think I've ever heard of one doing corrections, though.
Well, but that's not true. The Atlanta Braves had a pitcher named Pat a pitcher named Pat Jarvis, who became the sheriff of DeKalb County, which is the county directly east of Atlanta. He played for the Braves and he became the sheriff. So but the salaries back in the days we're talking about when Wetzel played and Hank Aaron, the salaries were just minuscule by today's standards. I mean, when you inflate Hank Aaron's $100,000 a year salary for inflation from the 1970s, he would be making $900,000 today, not 7 million or 8 million or 12 million or 14 million a year, like they're like people are earning these days for playing sports. I mean, is it possible that it's the same person? I have no idea. All of our listeners in PA, you can tell us, is John Wetzel a former basketball player?
And you could also throw in there that Stephen Seagal became like an honorary sheriff. Wasn't that in Arizona?
I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure. Hang on. I'm looking it up now.
But how many Wetzels have you met in your life?
Very few. Oh, he's a reserve deputy chief in Jefferson Parish, Louisiana. How about that?
Who is
Stephen Seagal? He's an actor.
So, but all right. In terms of this, with his innocence claim, it's a sad thing because apparently there was significant support that he should not have been in prison for all these years.
Certainly.
So there was evidence to support his claim, I should say, and
because the Innocence Project doesn't take on just every willy-nilly case. There has to be some sort of decent chance.
Yes.
To even take it on, to put forth the man hours to try and get you released.
The resources they have are so minuscule compared with the need that they have to be very selective. Right. I mean, and let me try to explain that. This is for me to pontificate. If you're out looking for funding for something like the Innocence Project, first of all, you're not going to find most of your Fortune 500 companies are not going to be, that's not going to be where they're looking to put their philanthropic resources. So you get money to pay these poor attorneys and these investigators to try to pursue these claims of innocence. And if you just take every comer that comes off the street that says, hey, I'm innocent, and you don't ever actually take a claim that works, it's very difficult to go back to your funders and say, we're actually freeing innocent people. So therefore, as a part of the process of screening cases so that you can justify your existence and inspire your donors to keep giving, you have to be selective about the cases you take. Otherwise, if you go back and say, well, we took 114 cases in the fiscal year, how many got out? Nobody. Right. But there's a big need for what we're doing.
Sure.
So that's why they have to be so selective, because it's an innocence project, and nobody will fund a project that no one's ever found to be innocent, because it kind of defeats you can't make a credible argument that all these people are in prison that shouldn't be if you can't ever succeed. So that's why they have to be so selective.
Certainly. Mm-mm-mm. God, it's just, I can't imagine you're like, yes, I'm going to get out. And then all of a sudden this thing happens and boom, 3 months later you croak because of it.
Tragic.
That's our compassionate system that we have here. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. All the way to the bank, Larry.
Yep.
We have, next up is an article from the Washington, what do you call it? The Washington what?
Compost.
Got it. This is DC jail inmates with coronavirus barred from access to lawyers. That sounds like a constitutional violation. Maybe they're in DC. They don't have constitutional rights because it's not a state. Family, showers, and changes of clothing, inspectors say. Why would they like have reduced access to these kinds of things? Across the 1,442 prisoner system, inspectors found inmates lack adequate cleaning equipment, training to disinfect cells, toilet areas, and communal areas. What's the problem with that, Larry?
Well, it's another tragedy that I was feared. How's that for a word? Afeared. I was afeared of that this would happen, because in my mind with no medical experience whatsoever, it would seem reasonable to me that you're going to have to really make an effort at sanitation. And that means laundry has to be increased, means that cleaning of the housing units, all the bedding, everything has to be increased. The clothing has to be increased. Well, that's difficult to do if you're overcrowded to begin with. And if you start having staff shortages because people don't want to work there, because they become infected, and that scares off the rest of the people. So the whole system will begin to break down, because if you have a staff of 300 for the 1,400 inmates, and the 100 of those quit showing up for work because of fear, how much work can the 200 do that are remaining?
Yeah, you end up with some bad problems.
And again, that's why we needed to clear out the facilities of as many people as possible, because once you do that, you can put distance between people, you can increase the laundry, you may have to give some inmates some extra incentives to work around the clock, but I'm confident that if I'm in charge of a correctional facility, I bet I can find people who will do laundry around the clock and people who will clean housing and common areas around the clock. I believe I can pull that together. I really do.
If you get I think you could pull it off.
I don't think it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. I think you can do things like extra good time. I think you can do things like extra privileges, and I think that the cost would be very minimal to really increase the operational capacity of how the facilities operate in normal times. In normal times, they won't let you have very many extra sheets and stuff because we do laundry here once a week, and your housing unit, you get your new sheets on Tuesday, and that's the way it is. You get your new jumpsuit every Tuesday, and that's the way it is, or every Thursday or whatever, and that's the way it is. You could probably describe that routine better than I can. How often did you get your stripes in Georgia?
They did laundry multiple days a week, 2 or 3 days a week. I'm pretty sure it was three, like, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday kind of thing. Maybe it was a Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. I'm pretty sure it was Monday, Wednesday,
How often did you get to trade your stuff out for new? How often did you get to get new uniforms and new bedding?
They would do like a sheet teardown, like that was a one day out of the week. So your bed was supposed to be unmade. A lot of people would just throw their stuff in their locker and hide it so they didn't have to wait for their stuff to come back. Plus, oftentimes, stuff doesn't come back. But as far as like your other uniforms and stuff, you would just do them with the laundry like normal. They would just bleach the crap out of it and wash it in 1,000-degree temperature water. So you could do it any time during the week.
But I'm assuming you had more than one uniform, otherwise you would have been nude. So mm-hmm. they gave you a number of three uniforms.
Three, right? Something like that, yeah. Yeah. So then yeah. You would have and one, then one in your locker, and then one in the laundry, kind of sort of always.
Yeah.
Maybe it was five. So, I don't think it was five.
So did they run laundry daily to the housing unit where you could throw your uniform one in there every day or twice a week?
No, it'd be three times a week. Like I said, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I think. It's been a while now.
So
and not something that I try to reflect on and being like, wow, this is happy times. Do you remember back in the day when we were doing... No, I don't really reminisce like that.
it's sad that that this is going on, but at least it's getting some attention. But yes. Well, the attention will probably be too little too late.
Yeah, and as soon as everybody goes back to going to Hooters and whatnot, like who's going to give a crap about the inmates then?
So,
all right, nobody. Let's go to M as in Michael, NPR News. ACLU sues to release Moose Lake inmates due to COVID-19. This sounds like a kind of a regurgitation on the other articles that we've had. Not to discount the people from Minnesota, but it seems like
this is big. This is the civil commitment. This is the one where this is the people who are in that special civil commitment for sexual offenders. And a federal district judge had found it to be unconstitutional. And then the Eighth Circuit overturned the district judge saying that you don't have a right to get out. There's to be released from civil commitment. You have the opportunity under the law. Therefore, it's not unconstitutional. And now these people are essentially in prison. I mean, it's as close as to prison as you can imagine. And so they're saying, well, since we're not prisoners, we're civil, we're patients. Let us out during this crisis. And that's what they sued for.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. Okay. You think they'll gain traction?
It'll probably be too little too late, being that the courts are working on slow schedules these days. And then
there's a huge backlog once they do finally get back to a normal schedule. There's going to be a gigantic backlog if the courts weren't already stacked to the gills with overloaded work as it is.
Well, the judge that had the previous case he got flipped or overturned, is what flip means. He got overturned. If he happened to have gotten this case assignment again, he's going to be a little gun shy. When you're flipped by the appellate court, it makes you a little gun shy the next time around. So he's probably going to be, if this case came up, of course, he can always recuse himself and say he doesn't think he can be impartial and he can punt the case to someone else. But I just think it's going to be too little too late.
Gotcha. And then we have another article from law.com, which is titled, let me get down to it. This is legal malpractice claims against public defenders subject to Tort Claims Act. Larry, I understand every word in this article, but I do not understand what Tort Claims Act is. I don't understand how this gets put together.
Well, this one won't take a lot of time. It just means that if you feel like that you've been improperly represented, which is a pretty hard barrier to prove that you had malpractice, like medical malpractice. People make a big to-do about medical malpractice, but most of them go nowhere. if you feel like that your attorney has committed an act of malpractice, which is not the same as you didn't like the outcome. It's that there were actually tangible things that the attorney should have done that would have made the outcome different, all but for those mistakes. If you're going to sue the public defenders, and this is out of the state of New Jersey, you have to comply with the elements of the Tort Claims Act. Tort means an injury. And if you're going to claim that you were injured by the New Jersey Public Defender's Office, you have to submit a notice within 90 days of the injury, preserving your opportunity to bring that claim. So everybody in New Jersey, if you think your attorney committed malpractice, you've got 90 days to file that notice. Otherwise, you're going to be barred by the Tort Claims Act. You won't be able to seek any redress because of your failure to put the state on notice that you have a claim.
And tort is just a legal word for injury? I know you just said that.
That's all it is, yes.
Okay. Obviously not physical?
Any type of injury can be physical, but yes, you've got an injury by the lawyer's incompetence or omissions.
Okay. I'm trying to wrap my head around the actual meaning of this, just for my own personal. So I'm taking one moment to go, now I understand. Oh, hey, and then let's punish you for being in prison in Alabama. Alabama reopens what is called a deplorable prison to quarantine new prisoners. Wow. This place...
Not new prisoners.
Well, it says to the quarantine people, new prisoners. That's what it does say.
Well, the people who have been tested positive for COVID-19.
Right. It does say so they're not following a 30-day moratorium. Anyway, either way, Larry, they're being put in a shitty place. And I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing because this is like, well, it's deplorable. It's just terrible. What is wrong with this place?
Well, it was closed in 2018 for being notoriously horrible and outdated. And it was going to cost millions to bring it up to standards to renovate it. And it looks like now that the way to deal with people who become sick is to move them to what was previously a condemned prison. But the Alabama Department of Corrections says that they have renovated the particular section where they're going to be putting these inmates. And that's going to relieve the overcrowding at two facilities in Alabama, which are grossly overcrowded. Staten is operating at 274%, and Elmore is at 200%, according to the Corrections Department statistics. So, again, we talked about cutting the prison population by half. If you cut those two prisons by half, one of them would still be above capacity. The one at Staten, if that's the way they pronounce it, would be still overcrowded. And these to put the people that have these, I guess you can have it without getting really sick. But it just seems like that when you have a person that's sick, you wouldn't want to put them in a dilapidated place.
You do have a tendency when someone is sick that they like to, you know, it seems for their own self-interest, for their best interest, that you would put them in a comfortable place, like climate controlled, and then, I'm pretty sure that this is not how they're going to be treated in the end. They're going, almost like how we shackle pregnant women. Like, I don't see why we would do that, but, you know, so, of course, if you get sick in prison, it's just, here's some Motrin, I hope you feel better, F you.
Well, it says at Staten, 68 men share three toilets and three sinks in one dorm.
I don't think that's an uncommon ratio, to be honest with you.
That seems like you'd have a lot of competition for those toilets.
Yeah, you better plan ahead, because if you're like, oh crap, I've got a crap, and the three people are using it, like you're in deep kimchi.
Yeah, that just seems hard to relate to when in the private world we're unhappy if we don't have our own. My brother has a house that was built in the 50s. In those days, they built homes where families grew up, raised families, and you'd have three bedrooms and one bath. And now he talks about no one can live in that house with him because it only has one bathroom. I said, well, that's strange. In the 1950s, people raised families in this very home and didn't think anything about it. But now no one can live here with you. You must have this entire place by yourself because it only has one bathroom. So to think about 68 people sharing three, that's quite strange.
My one thing about this particular thing is, so there was a Department of Justice investigator called conditions at the facility deplorable and noted numerous dangerous and unsanitary conditions. This is where it gets to be my favorite, including raw sewage, vermin. I love that word, Larry, and toxic fumes. Vermin. I think that means rats. I think.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the picture there, does that remind you of what the dormitory looked like? This is Elbar.
Exactly what it looks like there.
I don't see how you could do any. How would you do any social distancing there?
The best you can, man. Just make it work. People would most likely be walking around with t-shirts wrapped around their heads.
But those get laundered once a week, so that they're gross to begin with.
I completely agree and understand. And people try to, you know, the bottom bunk, they would try to set up little tents. That would help you to a certain degree. But the person on the top bunk is that people are just walking by, hacking up a lung right on your bunk. Person on the bottom just has, I can't say it, Larry. I can't say what is right in your face when you're on a bottom bunk and someone walks by. You know what I'm
saying?
This
is a family oriented program.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it, but I'm not going to say it. And we have an article from cleveland.com. Ohio prisoners with confirmed coronavirus cases skyrockets overnight as state increases inmate testing. That's a novel concept, Larry. Like, how would you know how many people are infected with a thing if you didn't have tests for them to test for the thing?
That's the whole thing that's been going on throughout this, is that it was something that I don't want to point fingers because I don't know the intricacies of having a test and being able to test at a level, appropriate level, but clearly there's a lot more of this out there than we know about simply because tests have been so limited. You have to beg for a test.
Yep.
And I personally know the public defender here in our state that tested positive, and she had to beg for days and days to get a test. And it was only when she got sick that they finally agreed to test her. Now, the president says that the testing is going to get better and better, and it has gotten better, but initially that testing was almost impossible.
I know that when they first started detecting it, that you would almost like eliminate it. So, you know, you would test for the flu. Nope, wasn't that. You would test for this. You would test for that. You'd do chest x-rays. And you would do all these things to be like, we know that it's not this. We know that it's not that. We know it's not this. And all we're left with is, it's probably this. Go quarantine yourself.
Well, and the number of staffers in Ohio prisons with it is up to 159 as of the writing of this article.
Hmm.
That's... Mm-mm-mm. But what is that going to do on the call-in rate of people who are not going to show up for work? Well, you got that many staffers testing positive. I mean,
true.
It's one thing to sit in your office and hang out in the staff lounge and chew up the fat and let the inmates make it by themselves. But if you're chewing up the fat with the staffers and they're all infected also, that's, you're not going to want to go to work.
Totally, I'm with you.
And they've approved releasing 105 inmates from state prisons in Ohio.
Yes.
105. That's going to make a difference.
That's a dramatic decrease, man. That'll work. That'll do it.
And it would make a difference if you're one of those 105.
Yeah, and that's the story that you tell about the mass riot, I think it was in your state 700 years ago?
Yeah, the one we talked about in 1980. Yep.
1980.
That's the one when I tell about the one day makes a difference. When people say, what difference does a day make when you're getting out of prison? I said, well, if you were in prison on this date in 1980 and you got released, it made all the difference in the world. That's what difference a day made, because 33 inmates died and dozens more were injured. It made a big difference that one day.
Should have thought about that before you did your crime. But before you did your felony jaywalking, you should have thought about that.
Well, we read the names of those people and they were very young, and it was very touching 40 years later to read the names, because we had... In those days, we had only that one prison. We had very little separation between the non-serious offenders, and it was just a tough place to send people to, and as the outcome showed.
Well, that was a happy show, Larry. I think we can wrap it up. Are you ready?
I am. So how do people get in touch with us if they want to?
If they want to, you certainly should go visit registrymatters.co, and you can find show notes, which will have links to all of the articles that we covered tonight. There will be a transcript there, so you can read along with our happy thoughts for the evening. I'm sure your favorite place to have them get in touch with us is with a voicemail message. And what is the phone number for them to reach us?
747-227-4477. Now, what will the transcript do with when I say "afeared"? How will it transcribe that?
It probably would actually spell it. I mean, feared. Yeah, feared is a word, so it would separate out and say feared. It's not going to do grammar checking, so it'll probably pull that one off as two different words. Just a guess. But there are sometimes some words like I bet you it doesn't do bestest or worser. I bet you it doesn't pull that one off. How about email, Larry? I know that you're reading our emails on a daily basis. How do people email us?
Oh, that's easy. That's registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And I'm going to alter things here just ever so slightly. Please visit patreon.com/registrymatters if you would like to become a patron. If you are unable to become a patron, go to the Apple Podcast, go to Google Podcast, go to any of those places where you download your podcast and leave us a review, preferably a 5-star review. Say something nice about us, and that will help other people find us. And, you know, we received a YouTube compliment very recently of someone just saying, stupendous content, keep up the great work. So, I mean, that just helps people, you know, even go to YouTube and give us a thumbs up, subscribe over there. And so that'll do it, man. I think that's all I got.
Thank you, Andy. Yeah, the thumbs up helps, from what little I understand. When you get thumbs up, more people want to look at it. They say, wow, there's 12 thumbs up. Well, this must be a good thing to listen to.
Absolutely. I appreciate your time and expertise and knowledge, Larry. Thank you, Richard, for chiming in. And thank you to all of those in chat, all of you people in chat. And like I said, Larry, thank you very much. I hope you have a great weekend and stay safe.
Good night.